We opened up Fresh Air today with Benny Goodman and his 1935 recording of Hunkadola. Terry Gross will be at National Public Radio in Washington for the next 2 weeks, where she has been invited to co-host All Things Considered with Noah Adams. Terry will be back in 2 weeks hosting Fresh Air in Philadelphia, but beginning tonight at 5, you can hear her on All Things Considered live from National Public Radio. But why wait until 5 o'clock? At 4 o'clock, we'll hear an interview Terry recorded with David Attenborough, host and writer of the PBS series The Living Planet, which is now being rebroadcast on Channel 12 and Channel 23. The series takes viewers around the world to environments of 63 countries on 7 continents. Attenborough estimates he journeyed more than 150,000 miles, or 3 times around the globe, to make the series. We'll hear that interview at 4 o'clock. My first guest on Fresh Air is Polish poet, novelist, essayist, and translator Czesław Miłosz, who received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1980. Czesław Miłosz is regarded as the greatest living poet writing in Polish. His work is praised for being deeply concerned with political and moral conflicts. Miłosz was born in Lithuania in 1911 and grew up in Eastern Europe during a period of chaos and sweeping social changes, including the Russian Revolution and both world wars. His father was an engineer and took the family with him as he traveled through Eastern Europe building bridges for the Russian army. For 6 years, the Miłosz family lived nomadically in covered wagons and in train cars. Following World War I, Miłosz lived in Poland, attending Catholic school. He became interested in Marxism while attending the university and became a leader in the avant-garde poetry movement in Poland during the 1930s. During World War II, Miłosz lived in Warsaw and worked as a writer and editor for resistance publications. He served as a Polish diplomat following the war, but severed his ties with the Polish government in 1951. Since 1960, Miłosz has lived in America. He now teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. Czesław Miłosz will read his poetry in Polish and English tonight at the Old Pine Street Church at 4th and Pine Streets. The program begins at 8 o'clock and is sponsored by the American Poetry Center. And for more information, I'll give you a toll-free 800 number you can call. That's 1-800 and dial the letters ALLMUSE, A-L-L-M-U-S-E. And that's tonight at 8 o'clock, Czesław Miłosz reading poetry at the Old Pine Street Church at 4th and Pine Street. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for being here today. Could you start by reading some poetry?
Yes, I would start by a poem, A Song on the End of the World. First, I would read it in Polish and then in English. Piosenka o końcu świata. W dzień końca świata pszczoła krąży nad kwiatem nasturcji, rybak naprawia błyszczącą sieć. Skaczą w morzu wesołe delfiny, młode wróble czepiają się rynny i wąż ma złotą skórę, jak powinien mieć. W dzień końca świata kobiety idą polem pod parasolkami, pijak zasypia na brzegu trawnika, nawołują na ulicy sprzedawcy warzywa i łódka z żółtym żaglem do wyspy podpływa. Dźwięk skrzypiec w powietrzu trwa i noc gwiaździstą odmyka. A którzy czekali błyskawic i gromów, są zawiedzeni. A którzy czekali znaków i archanielskich trąb, nie wierzą, że staje się już. Dopóki słońce i księżyc są w górze, dopóki trzmiel nawiedza róże, dopóki dzieci różowe się rodzą, nikt nie wierzy, że staje się już. Tylko siwy staruszek, który byłby prorokiem, ale nie z prorokiem, bo ma inne zajęcie, powiada, przewiązując pomidory. Innego końca świata nie będzie, innego końca świata nie będzie. This poem was written in Warsaw in 1943, when the end of the world was really taking place. And since that time, I am somewhat skeptical because the world is going on and the final end seems to be very remote. The human species is very tough. The same poem I am going to read in English. On the day the world ends, a bee circles a clover, a fisherman mends a glimmering net, happy porpoises jump in the sea, By the rain spout young sparrows are playing, and the snake is gold-skinned, as it should always be. On the day the world ends, women walk through the fields under their umbrellas. A drunkard grows sleepy at the edge of a lawn. Vegetable peddlers shout in the street, and a yellow-sailed boat comes nearer the island. The voice of a violin lasts in the air and leads into a starry night. And those who expected lightning and thunder are disappointed. And those who expected signs and archangels' trumps do not believe it is happening now. As long as the sun and the moon are above, as long as the bumblebee visits a rose, as long as rosy infants are born, no one believes it is happening now. Only a white-haired old man who would be a prophet, yet is not a prophet for he's much too busy, repeats while he binds his tomatoes. There will be no other end of the world. There will be no other end of the world.
It was Czesław Miłosz reading his poem, A Song on the End of the World, and he'll be reading this evening at the Old Pine Street Church at 4th and Pine Streets at 8 o'clock. Well, thank you for sharing that poem. You grew up hearing a very rich mix of languages, Polish, Yiddish, Russian, Lithuanian. Did hearing all those languages, do you think that affected your poet's ear and just how you heard language?
Yes, I guess so. I feel that those who grew up in a milieu of one language only has a ear slightly different. There is a kind, I imagine, of a competition in your ear of various tonalities.
You also grew up at in an age of real social upheaval, really through the beginning of the century in Eastern Europe. Do you look back on your life now and think, in terms of the opportunity that this, and I don't mean to think in terms of thing to talk of world wars merely as artistic opportunities for poets to write poems about, but do you look back in any way with a sense of that you really were born into a time that called forth for your poetic instinct in writing the history of the world the way you see it through poetry?
You see, when I was in Salem, and I visited the house of witches. I saw there some implements of the 17th century interior of America of that time. And I thought that precisely I grew up in the 17th century because all those objects which surrounded me in my childhood were identically like those museum pieces preserved from the 17th century in America. I went through in my life through so many different phases, beginning with my childhood, early childhood in Lithuania, which is besides the subject of my novel, the Isa Valley, which takes place in 1920s in Lithuania. Well, that was an extremely traditional world, and I went through many turmoils in my life.
What type of life did your parents prepare you for? What were their aspirations for you?
Well, I guess that they wanted me to be a professional, trained in a profession, probably a technical profession or a medical doctor. I don't think they had a very precise vision what I would do.
Did they see you ever leaving Eastern Europe, do you think?
Yes. At that time, the vision of migration was very remote, I should say. It was not, let us say, America. America seemed to be very far away. And migrating to other countries of Europe, why? What for? Yeah.
Your father was an engineer and, I understand, traveled around Eastern Europe in Russia to help build bridges for the Russian army and took the family with him.
No, even before the war and revolution, his first assignment was in Siberia, and he enjoyed that, and we went together with him. I was a small child, but that was my first international travel to Asia.
How do you recall that period of how you lived? In reading your history about your life, Native Realm, you talk about living in train cars and out of covered wagons.
Yes, that's the fact. Yes, during the First World War, we accompanied my father in his wanderings, and then there was a Soviet Polish war. My father was in the Polish army, so there was a lot of wanderings. But I should say I had a very happy childhood in general.
So you look back at that as a period of freedom, as opposed to of deprivation.
There were periods of terror, of course. I don't know. Maybe those moments of terror influence a child very strongly. Maybe it's suppressed later on in memory. But I remember mostly happy moments. There were happy moments, happy vacations in Lithuania, and I was very happy.
What caused the moments of terror for you?
Well, there was, artillery fire or... during the Russian Revolution, when I was... a child and left alone, and suddenly a soldier came who was my friend, really, but he was covered with blood, and he came because he was chased by other soldiers. He had killed a man, and he jumped into my room looking for protection because he knew my father and hoped that my father would hide him. But I was alone in the room, and of course, such moments of terror. Yeah.
When you, after traveling for the 6 years or so in Siberia and elsewhere with your family and settling down in the city of Vilna, you went to Catholic school, and I'm just wondering if it was difficult for you to adjust to something as regimented as Catholic school after having experienced the freedom of traveling and being out in nature with your family.
It was not really a Catholic school because it was a government school, and according to an agreement between Poland and the Vatican, we had lessons of religion as part of curriculum, Catholic religion. Of course, non-Catholics had their own lessons. But, of course, the influence of the priest was very strong throughout the school. No, but the difficulty of adjustment was not that. Difficulty of adjustment was due to the fact that I was practically always alone before, given to my child's fantasies, and suddenly I found myself in a group of noisy boys, mostly much stronger than myself and older than myself, belated in their studies, and that was difficulty of adjustment.
How did you take to the religious beliefs which were taught in the school? Did you accept them or did you reject them?
Yes, I accepted. I received a very Catholic education. However, at a given moment, I became a rebel, and I started to ask questions, improper questions, during my religion class. And so for a while, I was a kind of a black sheep in school.
Well, what type of questions were you asking? What were you probing when you would ask the rebellious question?
I think now of that religious curriculum in our school very highly. It was on a very high level, and thanks to that, I know many things which I wouldn't have known. It was really on a level of a Catholic seminary. And, of course, the problems which thorny questions in which theology abounds. So I have been thinking on those problems all my life. For instance, the problem of evil. Why evil? Why suffering? Why good God allows suffering? But another Nobel laureate, my colleague from Poland, Isaac Bashevis Singer, tells in his autobiography that he started to ask those questions when he was 5 and that he has been working all his life on those questions.
Did the church seem to have answers for you when you were in school to those questions of evil and those other large questions that you asked about the world?
No, maybe our priest was unable to cope with very difficult questions. Gradually we learn that there are some questions which cannot be answered. When we advance in life, we know that not everything can be reduced to the language and to the logic. And there are realms of experience which escape that. And besides, the question of evil has been asked for centuries, first by Job, in the book of Job, and there is no answer to that.
Did the school that you were in condemn or criticize the Russian Revolution at all because the revolution did not hold theological beliefs?
No. In Poland at that time was a general loathing of the revolution in Russia because, first of all, it was considered as a kind of a continuation of the Russian Tsarist regime because they were Russians. And because of direct experiences during the Polish-Soviet War in 1919-20. However, I should say that the leader of Poland at the time, Józef Piłsudski, didn't want to help white Russian generals, considering that the Russian Revolution would lead to a certain long time of turmoil during which Russia would be less imperialistic and less dangerous, while the Tsarist Russia had been imperialist, and in case of restoration of Tsardom, it would be continuously imperialistic.
But so the fact that there was a revolution did not at all really improve relations between the Poles and the Russians in the 1920s?
No. There was a war. There was a war in 1919. Poles, Piłsudski in any case, had a vision of a federation, a Polish, Belarusian, Ukrainian federation, and he went and occupied Kiev in 1919. The Soviet army rolled the Polish army back and reached the gates of Warsaw in summer 1920. And a decisive battle took place in which the Soviet army was beaten and retreated many hundreds of kilometers, and a new border was a result of a kind of a compromise.
During this time when you were in school in Poland and in your teens, I'm wondering, what were your visions of America like? What type of images did you have of life in America?
Well, I should say that my generation and and previous generations were strongly influenced by a romantic image of America. My father grew up on novels about America already. And myself too. Many writers who are unknown in America, like a German Karl May, never heard here, or an Irishman, Thomas Mayne Reid, wrote novels about life in America. Karl May, who never been in America, he wrote that novel as a sort of a tall tale about himself sitting in prison for debts. So those were romantic pictures of Indians, of noble-minded redskin gentlemen, and wars and animals hunting and so on. Very strong impact. But that's only romantic America. When I was in high school, however, at the university, there was a flood of American literature of realistic sort. Upton Sinclair, for instance, translated, Dreiser translated into Polish. We read those novels, yes.
You wrote that William Faulkner had a great impact on you, and that it was that you could relate to the South.
No, Faulkner was absolutely unknown, and I found Faulkner very late, after the Second World War only, I discovered Faulkner.
I guess what I was going to ask you about Faulkner is that you were able to relate to the South that Faulkner wrote about and relate that somehow to your own background. It seems like such a disparate experience.
Yes, I feel that the South is closer perhaps to my traditions. Because the South was so rural society. And basically, I came from a rural society.
Did you see many American movies in Eastern Europe?
Of course. Well, I was brought up on American movies. I was brought up everything which an American of my age saw, I saw. Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, Lillian Gish. All those are familiar characters for me.
Did you adapt any of the styles, or did your friends adapt any of the styles which you saw, or emulate anything that you saw in the American movies?
I guess that American movies were shown all over Europe, you know, and certainly they had they had an impact. Fashions already at the time were becoming universal. Of course, those fashions which to us today seem so funny, but they spread thanks to the movies also. Yeah.
Do you think many people wanted to come to America after seeing American movies?
Hard to tell, you know. There was of course that thought and that dream maybe among the Jews in Poland, because they represented a different pattern. They represented an urban pattern, but in rural life in countryside. There was a different pattern. There was a big migration before World War I to America. And many families had relatives coming from villages migrating to America. After World War I, I guess the movement was mostly to France to work in mines. If I'm not mistaken, the number of migrants from the countryside to America was much smaller after the First World War.
My guest is poet Czesław Miłosz, and he'll be reading tonight at the Old Pine Street Church at 4th and Pine Streets at 8 o'clock. How did, I'd like to ask you about the relationships between Catholic and Jews previous to World War II. Mm-hmm. In the city that you were going to school and growing up in Vilna, how did Catholics and Jews get along in that city?
My impression is that conflicts between those two groups in Vilna was less pronounced than any than other cities. Other Polish cities. Of course, there were conflicts due to the fact that the Jews in Vilno spoke either Yiddish or Russian. Russian was adopted by them at the time of the Russian occupation, while the Poles spoke Polish, so that was a substratum of the language. That situation didn't look precisely like in other Polish cities, but slogans of anti-Semitic slogans didn't find in Vilno very much response.
Why do you think there was so much anti-Semitism elsewhere in Poland? Poland is regarded for a history of anti-Semitism.
Yes. Well, the reasons are when we start to discuss those things, this is an interminable discussion. In any case, I would like here to say that Hitler chose Poland as the territory of the extermination camps not because of anti-Semitism in Poland, but because Poland had the larger agglomeration of Jewish population. And together with the Soviet Union areas, that was precisely the place where the camps should be, from their point of view, placed. And on the other hand, there was another advantage that camps placed, let us say, in France or Belgium, they would be immediately known what was going on. But the Nazis were very clever to the extent that, as you probably know, people in the ghetto practically till the last moment didn't know what's going on, what happens to those who are taken out.
During World War II, you were a writer and an editor for resistance publications, and you were living in Warsaw at the time. What led you to become involved in this, and what were you actually doing? What were the goals of the publications? What were you hoping to accomplish?
You know, I was not a hero, and I was not alone in that. Simply from one day to another, when the Nazis occupied Poland, everything became illegal. There was no difference between a law-abiding citizen and those who transgressed. And from that point of view, whatever you did didn't matter very much because you were a potential victim. You would seize you in the street and take you to Auschwitz, and that was it. So there was a general, and since all publications were forbidden, the Poles were considered an inferior race, not deserving publications, not deserving theaters, not deserving universities. The universities were closed. So it was a natural thing to, since I was a writer and all the community of writers lived in the same way, namely path to resistance.
Did you see yourself as having a specific mission or a goal with the publications? Why did you do it? What were you hoping to accomplish?
I should say, to answer frankly your question, I did it because there was a great pressure of the community. As a writer, I had to respond. And I had many underground poetry readings. And there was an underground organization of theater people, Underground Theatrical Council, which was arranging spectacles of plays, clandestine spectacles, and clandestine poetry readings. A friend of mine from that council, from that resistance council, a very brave woman, arranged 150 poetry readings during the Nazi occupation. I took part in several of those poetry readings, which were a factor of maintaining morale and hope and stamina of people. Poetry, as I said, can be as important as bread.
What were the poems about? Were they about all facets of life, or did they concentrate on what you saw as the struggle for people living in Poland at the time?
Well, those were mostly poems on precisely the topic of resistance and of the Nazi occupation. And I published an anthology of anti-Nazi poetry in 1942. I edited. However, I should say that I do not. I touched upon that problem of poetry and resistance in some of my lectures and articles. The fact is that not necessarily what is moral in literature is the best as literature. And that's quite a dilemma. There is a poem of mine, for instance, entitled Campo di Fiori, which was written in 1943 when the German during the ghetto uprising in Warsaw and the Germans were destroying the last resistance of the ghetto. And I wrote then a poem entitled Campo di Fiori, which was printed in the underground and went abroad, smuggled abroad when the war still was going on. That poem has had some 8 Hebrew different Hebrew translations. Well, I don't know whether this is a good poem, but this is a poem of a moral indignation, of a moral protest, of a moral value as a document of protest.
Could I ask you to read another poem? It's one that you wrote in Warsaw.
Yes.
If before reading it, perhaps you could say a few words about either what it's about or what was going through your mind as you wrote it.
Well, this poem was written in 1945 on the ruins of Warsaw. Warsaw at that time was destroyed. And the Soviet army occupied the city belatedly when the Nazis had succeeded in crushing the uprising of 1944. And the whole population had been deported to concentration camps in Germany. So the city was really a desert of rubble. And I returned then to the city and looked at that, and I was thinking about those who perished, who were killed fighting the Nazis. And those which not necessarily I was in agreement politically, but I honored their stamina. dedication. You, whom I couldn't save, listen to me. Try to understand this simple speech as I would be ashamed of another. I swear there is in me no wizardry of words. I speak to you with silence, like a cloud or a tree. What strengthened me for you was little. You mixed up farewell to an epoch with the beginning of a new one, inspiration of hatred with lyrical beauty, blind force with accomplished shape. Here is the valley of shallow Polish rivers and an immense bridge going into white fog. Here is a broken city, and the wind throws the screams of gulls on your grave when I am talking to you. What is poetry which didn't save nations or people? A connivance with official lies, a song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment, readings for sophomore girls. That I wanted good poetry without knowing it, that I discovered late its salutary aim, in this and only this I find salvation. They used to pour millet on graves or poppy seeds to feed the dead who would come disguised as birds. I put this book here for you, who once lived, so that you should visit us no more.
It's my guest, Czesław Miłosz, who will be reading this evening at the Old Pine Street Church at 8 o'clock, and that's at 4th and Pine Streets. In your book, Native Realm, which you call an autobiographical history, I believe, you recall a time at the end of the war, and you write about being in a house where a German prisoner of war with, and you recall him having a long white sheepskin coat, is being held, and this German POW is killed by the Russian soldiers who are in the house. Could you tell this story and speak to why it's an important memory to you?
Well, it is very important for me because it was not accompanied by any violence. That was a prisoner of war and treated very kindly by those soldiers. And somehow they knew, however, that they cannot keep him, that they have to kill him. They gave him a cigarette and they lied that he would be peacefully taken away to another unit. So they played a kind of a comedy, and that was striking. Precisely that humanitarian aspect, screening the act.
Was that typical? Did you see? Were there other acts of other humanist type acts that you saw in the midst of all the terrors of the war?
No, it seems to me that that was a basic contrast between naked cruelty of the Nazis and. That was sort of a peaceful way, very typical of the Soviets, and because I believe that they are very trained in not telling the truth any time, even to themselves.
In your lifetime, the history of Eastern Europe has been. Quite chaotic, given the wars and the revolution that began at the beginning of your life in Russia, World War I and World War II. I'm wondering how this chaos and instability, which has been the history of Eastern Europe in this century, has maybe affected the way Eastern Europeans would view the world, as opposed to, let's say, the way Americans view the world.
Yes, Well, I have many discussions, very amusing, humorous discussions with my American friends. And we see, we can verify our different reactions to certain things. My reactions are always fatalistic. Things are bad and they would turn to worse. So that should be expected. When I park my car, my American friends laugh at me because I park many, even a block before. They go straight and they find a place. So those are two different attitudes.
Yet you found that you've had to confront the fact that the theories of cataclysm that you thought in the 30s, maybe the world has not ended. So you've had to change your worldview about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that my reactions, my fatalistic and apocalyptic reactions, are not necessarily the best and the sanest. I have modified to a large extent my pessimistic views.
Do you think that the way people who live in Eastern Europe, how that history of chaos, how has that affected the way that Eastern Europeans would relate to government and statehood?
Well, I prefer the term of Central Europe to the term of Eastern Europe, because Eastern Europe is Russia, at least till the Ural Mountains. Central Europe are countries between Germany and Russia, I should say. I don't know. I believe that every decade brings in new elements. And if we take Poland as an example, the appearance of the solidarity movement in Poland changed that completely pessimistic and fatalistic attitude towards an attitude of relative hope, let us say.
Do you think poetry is regarded differently in Poland than it is in the United States?
Oh, yes, but this is nothing new. It has been rooted in the past, in the past centuries. I don't know how to explain it, in different role of the language. Maybe a much stronger impact of the language in those countries, sensitivity to the language.
Well, it seems that poetry may play a more political role in Poland, as it does perhaps also in Central America, where, for instance, the heads of governments in Central American countries are poets.
Yeah, but let us look. Since we are now in Philadelphia, it's proper to speak of Walt Whitman. And I had a clipping from the New York Times on the day of Whitman's death that was obituary. This was a small piece of, you know, in case, imagine that such a poet dies in any of those countries over there, and it would be a national, really, mourning.
So it's a huge difference.
Yes, yes.
Is there a period of your poetry that is most important to you personally?
Well, I guess that I have been maturing slowly. At 75, I still hope that I am maturing. And so I defined my poetry as an escape forward. I said that how one becomes a writer, one writes one book and considers it not satisfactory. So in order to escape forward, writes another book, and so on.
So it sounds like the next poem is always the most important one to you.
Yes, of course.
Do you ever think about writing poetry in English, or do you always write in Polish first and then translate or have other people translate for you?
No, I always write. In my life, I wrote one poem only in English. But I write only in Polish, and I prefer to translate. And even if I write essays, though I can write directly in English, I prefer to write first in Polish and then to translate myself.
Do you are you nervous about other people's translations of your poems?
Yes, I am nervous. I translate my poetry largely myself, and then submitting to some slight corrections by my friends. But of late, more and more I translate myself. The changes they introduce are very small.
Do you think poets are generally nervous about the quality of translations? Because it's such a subtlety of language, you know?
Yes. This is the reason why I prefer to translate myself. I'm nervous. Of course, there are other languages into which my poetry is translated and where I have to leave to the translator. I cannot control. Sometimes I am confronted with controversies, quarrels between translators. And I am in quandary, you know, how to... whom to trust? Yes, this is the case of my translations into Serbo-Croatian. In Yugoslavia, every book of mine have been translated. This is the case of my translations into French. I know French, but I cannot take part in, I cannot translate into every language.
Is there poetry that doesn't translate, do you think?
Yes, definitely. There is a type of poetry which is practically untranslatable. I consider that large part of Russian poetry, I'm very skeptical about translating Mandelstam. I know his poetry in original, and this is a poetry with stanzas, with rhymes and meter. It's very hard to translate into English.
Do you think of yourself as an historian at all? I'm thinking that so much of your poetry is chronicling the periods of, let's say, the poetry that you wrote during World War II when you were living in Warsaw and a member of the resistance there.
Yes. Well, I primarily think of myself as a poet, and I would prefer to live in less interesting period. I don't know whether you have heard that Chinese curse, let you live in interesting times. So certain things have been, so to say, imposed upon me as a testimony, as a witness. Who knows? I don't know how I will be judged by the future, by posterity. We never know.
You visited Poland in 1981. I guess that was the first time back for you in, what, about 22 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Was it strange for you to go back to Poland, which at that point was in the height of the Solidarity struggle?
Yes.
It's been said that one reason Solidarity has worked very well in Poland is that there's been, for one of the first times, a unity of between the workers in Poland and the intellectuals.
Yes.
In Poland. And I was going to ask you if this was true and how important that was.
That was crucial, very important. And when I met Lech Walesa and we became friends, I for the first time in my life, perhaps, I felt that this situation is normal, namely, that intellectuals and workers should have a common language. And a great merit in this respect in Poland, a great contribution was brought by my friend Adam Michnik, who was quite consciously in his program, in his philosophy, put as a basic issue to bring about the alliance between the workers and the intellectuals. And that became a fact a few years later. And now I am proud to say that a book of Adam Michnik, Letters from Prison, his essays, just came out, published by the University of California Press with my introduction. And Michnik is, by miracle nearly, again out of prison. For how long, I don't know, but he is. And of course, I rejoice. I took the telephone, I talked to him on the phone and congratulated him.
Are you able to keep in touch with those who you want to keep in touch with in Poland now?
Yes. Yes. I am, for instance, such people as Michnik. Even when he was in prison, I knew what was going on with him, and I followed his fates.
But could you have written to him or spoken with him?
Well, I have written, but a letter never reached him. Yeah.
How do you see your role in solidarity now, living in the United States?
Well, I am not engaged in a political struggle in any manner. I am a writer and I am an individualist. I am more or less like other writers, my colleagues from the writers' community. Our sympathies are obviously with Solidarity. Besides, the Union of Writers in Poland was disbanded by the government because precisely of that. So here I am not an exception. I am very much in the main current of the Polish intellectuals.
You've lived now in the United States since 1960, I guess.
Yes, since 1960, yes. Mm-hmm.
I guess at a certain point you ask, I mean, do you ask yourself now where you're from? Where you're living your present life now? I mean, do you think of yourself now as in the United States for the rest of your life, or do you?
Oh, yes, definitely. I feel American, and I am very attached to America. And I know that this is my home already. However, I continue to write in my language of my childhood, and I do not see any contradiction.
What have you liked best about living in this country that you might not have realized that you would come to like about living in America?
You know, to be frank, success is very important part of our adaptation to a given country. You can be integrated into a given country through your work. If you are successful in your work, if you are surrounded by people who esteem you, whom you esteem, you find your place in society. Whether this is university or a literary community or a factory or a store, that's how it is. If you are in the street without any job, without any integration, economic integration, that's bad. You cannot get integrated.
So it sounds like having had your work recognized is a important part of your life in America.
First, I arrived here as a, invited as a lecturer by the University of California, and after a few months I was offered tenure, which is not very often. I felt I couldn't refuse. I accepted it, and so I was first integrated into the university community. I had no problem of struggling, of difficulties in my life. I considered that was a very privileged position because I could write whatever I liked and not being forced by the law of the market. When I lived in France, I had to be very productive in the sense of publishing to earn some money. So that was first integration, and then came recognition as a poet, as a writer. So that's the second degree of integration in the American life.
Did winning the Nobel Prize in 1980 make a big difference in terms of what you could choose to do and not do, or did it change your life in any way, or did you try to avoid having it change your life in any way?
Well, it changed my life, but not internally. It changed some outside aspects of my life. As to my work, I decided that it shouldn't change. The day I received the Nobel Prize, I had normally my class. And since the time continued to work every day as before, as if nothing happened.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being here today on Fresh Air, talking about your life and your work, and ask you to read one more poem before you go.
Yes, I wonder. Maybe I would read you a poem. Since we spoke about my childhood, this is a poem entitled Rivers.
If you'd like to read it in Polish and English, that'd be...
Oh, wouldn't it be too long?
No, that would be okay if you...
Yeah, this is. I grew up in the city, which was called Vilno in Polish, and is called by Lithuanians Vilnius, by Russians Vilna. That's a very beautiful city on a very beautiful river. Not polluted. I don't know how it is now, but at that time was not polluted, and so I spent my adolescence swimming and canoeing. So I read it first in Polish and then in English. Rzeki. Pod rozmaitymi imionami was tylko sławiłem rzeki. Wy jesteście mleko i miód, i miłość, i śmierć, i taniec. Od źródła w tajemnych grotach bijącego spośród omszałych kamieni, gdzie bogini ze swoich dzbanów nalewa wodę żywą, od jasnych zdrojów na murawach, pod którymi szemrzą poniki, zaczyna się wasz bieg i mój bieg, i zachwyt, i przemijanie. Na słońce wystawiałem twarz, nagi, sterujący z rzadka zanurzeniem wiosła. I mknęły dębowe lasy, łąki, sosnowy bór. Za każdym zakrętem otwierała się przede mną ziemia obietnicy. Dymy wiosek, senne stada, loty jaskółek brzegówek, piaskowe obrywy. Powoli, krok za krokiem, wstępowałem w wasze wody. I nurt mnie podejmował milcząco za kolana. Aż powierzyłem się i uniósł mnie i płynąłem przez wielkie odbite niebo triumfalnego południa. I byłem na waszych brzegach o zaczęciu letniej nocy. Kiedy wytacza się pełnia i łączą się usta w obrzędzie. I szum wasz koło przystani, jak wtedy w sobie słyszę, na przywolanie, objęcie i na ukojenie. Z biciem we wszystkie dzwony zatopionych miast odchodzimy. Zapominanych witają poselstwa dawnych pokoleń. A pęd wasz nieustający zabiera dalej i dalej. I ani jest, ani było, tylko trwa wieczna chwila. The same poem in English, Rivers. Under various names I have praised only you, Rivers. You are milk and honey and love and death and dance. From a spring in hidden grottos, sipping from mossy rocks, where a goddess pours live water from a pitcher, at clear streams in the meadow, where rills murmur underground, your race and my race begin, and amazement and quick passage. Naked, I expose my face to the sun, steering with hardly a dip of the paddle. Oak woods, fields, a pine forest skimming by, around every bend the promise of the earth. Village smoke, sleepy herds, flights of martins over sandy bluffs. I entered your water slowly, step by step, and the current in that silence took me by the knees, until I surrendered, and it carried me, and I swam through the huge reflected sky of a triumphant noon. I was on your banks at the onset of midsummer night, when the full moon rolls out, and lips touch in the rituals of kissing. I hear in myself now as then the lapping of water by the boathouse and the whisper that calls me in for an embrace and for consolation. We go down with the bells ringing in all the sunken cities. Forgotten, we are greeted by the embassies of the dead, while your endless flowing carries us on, and neither is nor was, the moment only, eternal.
Thank you for reading that, and thank you for being here today on Fresh Air. My guest has been Czesław Miłosz, and he will read his poetry this evening in Polish and English at the Old Pine Street Church at 4th and Pine Streets. And the program begins at 8 o'clock. It's sponsored by the American Poetry Center. And if you'd like more information on that, you can call this number. It's a toll-free number, 1-800-ALL-MUSE. Just dial the numbers, the letters A-L-L-M-U-S-E. It's 6 minutes after 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My name's Danny Miller. I'm standing in this week and next week for Terry Gross. And Terry, you may have heard, is down in Washington. She's been invited by National Public Radio to guest co-host, All Things Considered, for the next 2 weeks. And so you can hear Terry tonight at 5 o'clock as we broadcast All Things Considered. She'll be co-hosting with NPR's Noah Adams. Right now, though, we have an interview which Terry Gross recorded with David Attenborough. The Living Planet, the PBS series tracing the Earth's geological cycles and showing how the Earth has developed over millions of years, is now being rebroadcast on channels 12 and 23. The Living Planet was conceived, written, and hosted by David Attenborough, who has produced natural history films for the BBC for over 30 years. The Living Planet, which follows up Attenborough's earlier series, Life on Earth, takes viewers around the world to 63 countries on 7 continents. From the highest to the lowest altitudes and from the poles to the equator, the program shows how plant and animal life have adapted to the environment. In the Philadelphia area, you can see The Living Planet on Channel 12, Saturdays at 9 p.m., with repeats the following Tuesdays at midnight. New Jersey Public Television, Channel 23, is playing The Living Planet Sundays at 9. David Attenborough is a zoologist educated at Cambridge University. He was program director at the BBC from 1966 through 1973. David Attenborough's brother Richard directed the films Gandhi and A Chorus Line. When Terry spoke with David Attenborough, she asked him to compare The Living Planet with his earlier series, Life on Earth.
Well, Life on Earth tried to show, to chart the development of animal life by devoting one program and one chapter of the book to a particular group of animals. So there's one on fish, and there was one on amphibians, one on reptiles, one on birds, so on. What that couldn't do, though, was to show a way in which animals of different groups interacted with one another. So on the bird program, you didn't see much about the insects that they fed on, for example. Neither could you see how human beings of all kinds, tribal as well as sophisticated, meshed into that pattern. So this new series aims to look at a group of environments, one per program. So there's one on deserts and there's one on jungles, one on mountains and so on.
How did you chart your course? Because you really did go up and down and north and south, travel the world several times over, I think, but you went to the most extreme climates.
Yes. Well, a lot of the ecosystems or environments, whatever you wish to call them, chose themselves. I mean, those I listed, deserts, jungles, grasslands, coasts, are all fairly obvious. So is mountains and snow, though you could have done one on snow and one on mountains, but we chose to do the same in one. And actually, it turns out to be at just about 12, which is what you need.
For a series, right?
Yes.
Were you careful to not go from the desert 1 month to the North Pole the other, so as to not be exposed to extremes yourself?
Not really. What actually happened is that I wrote the entire series before we start, because with a kind of mosaic series like this, in which you may hop from continent to continent, from the Sahara to the Mojave, in the desert program, for example, you have to know exactly why you're going where and what you're going to say when you get there. So you have to write the whole thing first. And then, of course, so you suddenly find you've got to go to, let's say, South America, Brazil, for the rainforest. But also you know that you're going to have to go and do the Amazon for the river program and the mangroves at the mouth at Belém for the coastland program and the Andes for the mountain program, so that you actually tend to do it in those kind of territories.
How did you decide what kind of crew and equipment you were going to take with you? Most people like to travel light when they're hiking through the mountains, which you can't really do when you're doing a television series.
No, but you still have the same ambition. You still have the same to do it as economically. And I don't mean that in terms of money, because, you know, I mean, of course, we all care about money, but that's not the critical factor. It is mobility and speed of getting around. You don't want to go and, if you can get in one Land Rover instead of two, that's better. And so we have an absolute minimum size crews. There's myself,